This is the Education Gadfly Show.
And most things in education reform, right? If there's any effect, it's modest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why is that? Rick?
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a true artist, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike. How you doing, baby?
Did you notice that reference to the Oscars?
The Oscars, yes. I got to say, man, that stuff was soporific this year. Billy Crystal looked like he was doing a retirement home.
Oh, my God. It was bad. That was really bad. And
I love Billy Crystal, but he was awful.
He was awful. I know. Well, there was a time and place for Billy Crystal, and I think that time and place was in the past.
I know. And he looked like somebody's grandmother, too. It was kind of weird. They needed to work on the makeup.
It was not good. You actually go and see movies, unlike me. Did you think this? Have you seen The Artist?
You know, I have not. But my brother's Sanford Theater has been showing it. I think he had to take it for like 6 or 8 weeks because it is, you know, he's got that single screen theater out in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. And I think that he got the exclusive thing for like whatever the region is, like 50 or 100 miles. But the distributor was like, okay, you got to show it for 6 or 8 weeks. But he was actually psyched if it won the Oscars. So I think he's making money hand over fist.
Oh, that's great. People are going to go see that movie.
People are like, oh my God, we got to see it, Mildred.
Excellent. And why didn't Woody Allen show up? What was the deal with that?
He never shows up.
He just does not show up.
He doesn't believe in prizes for movies. I think that's a...
Really? Is that it?
Yeah.
He's not just painfully shy?
No, I don't think he even went when he won for Annie Hall.
Give him some credit. So when they do the next time there's a round of awards for education reformers, Rick, and they want to give you an award, what are you going to do?
I never get awards, so it's pretty safe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But sometimes you're like the MC.
That's true. I do like MCing.
All right, Rick, we got to talk about something serious here on the show. And actually, you don't even know about this yet.
Oh.
We at Fordham are wondering about the future of the Education Gadfly Show podcast.
Mm.
The deal is here, listeners, is that we know we have a group of loyal listeners, but you're smaller than we wish you were. We get about 200 loyal listeners a week. And as we look at what it takes to put on this show, we're wondering if it really makes sense to keep doing this versus other things we could be doing with our time and money. Plus, not to mention your very expensive contract, Rick, which drives up the cost of this show tremendously.
But I like to thank you. When you work it out over a base of 200 listeners, it prorates out nicely.
Well, that's true. So here's the question. We're wondering if we should keep the show in the air. If you love this show, if you rely on it, now this sounds like some kind of NPR pitch here, okay? But still, if you rely on it, we need you to do two things. Okay, first of all, we need you to tell your friends and colleagues that they should be listening to this show too. Don't assume that they're already listening, because based on our numbers, chances are they're not. Okay. Second of all, if you're an influential person who is out there making change in education reform and this podcast matters to you, let us know about that. Convince us that we should keep it on the air.
What if you're not an influential person? Don't bother.
Keep it to yourself. Yeah.
Okay.
But let's say you're Arnie Duncan and you're listening secretly. We'd like to know that. That would be helpful.
I think the odds are slim.
Yeah, maybe. But he's, especially because he's so busy playing basketball.
He was hooping it up.
I understand.
I hear he had to play the celebrity game.
That's right. It was this no-look pass. Looked pretty good. Sure. All right. So here it is again. Tell your friends. Tell your colleagues. Get them to listen or email us at gadfly@edexcellence.net. That's gadfly. The gadfly@edexcellence.net. And tell us about your own need for the podcast and how it helps you do education reform better.
I'm glad I didn't know it was 200, or I would have stopped doing this years ago.
Well, for some reason, there was a period there before Joe came when one of our other producers convinced us that it was more like 2,000. And we liked that. We thought that was
pretty good. What happened to the other 1,800?
I think they never existed.
Either that or Joe chased them away.
Something like that. So, point being, let us know. Okay. On with the show. Lots to cover. Ty, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Last Friday, the New York City Department of Education released teacher ratings that were then published in major newspapers. Is this an effective and ethical way to increase transparency around teacher effectiveness?
Rick, we've talked about this before. I think we're both opposed to making this kind of information public, right?
Yes.
What about to parents?
What about it?
I mean, should the parents get access to this kind of data for their own kid's teacher?
I don't think so. I mean, look... yeah, this is a nice thing, right, about schools which are not administered by kind of government entities is, you know, I'm fine with schools choosing to make particular one-off policies on what they want to do with it and how they want to share information with parents. But, you know, my general attitude is employee evaluation data is useful to the people who are responsible for managing those employees. When I evaluate my team, I'm not going to share it with their parents. I'm not going to share it with funders who are funding our work. I'm not, when I'm evaluating people who work for me, I'm evaluating them so that I can use that and to make decisions about who to retain, how to evaluate, who to retain, who to reward, how to use people. And I think that's the appropriate use of data.
I get all that, Rick. But the relationship here is different. Okay, if you're a parent, you want to know if your child's teacher is apt to do a good job or not, particularly if you're going into a new grade. You know, it's summertime, you're getting ready for the fall, and you find out that your kid's going to have Mrs. Smith. Don't you have a right to know whether Mrs. Smith is one of the worst teachers in the school
district? Well, it partly depends how, you know, reliable and how you know, relevant you think these metrics are. I don't actually think value-added reading and math scores tell you whether the teacher is one of the best or worst.
So forget the New York data. What about if in places where, like, say, D.C., with the impact system, which much more robust, comprehensive, includes value-added, but lots of other stuff too, and it boils down to a score at the end if the teacher is highly effective or ineffective?
I think you get the same problem. You know, this is the reason that management data, I think, doesn't get, you know, John Fullerton, I wrote about this years ago, the numbers we need. The problem with trying to use management data for public transparency is you now have reasons to cook and manipulate management data.
All right,
data.
But that's not transparent. I mean, what if I'm
if I'm a principal and I'm evaluating my teacher and that's part of what's showing up in that number at the end of the year, I have now incentive to inflate all my teacher evaluations because I want parents to feel good about the teacher they're getting.
I see that, Rick, but isn't this a little bit like a relationship with, say, a doctor? I mean, that you should have the ability to see, you know, you can go on websites and find out information about a doctor that you might be choosing. Why can't you get the same thing for a teacher?
Well, you should be able to get information on the teacher, but it's what's available on those doctor websites. I don't believe, I could be proven wrong. I'm pretty confident they don't have convalescence rates, mortality rates for specific patients under that care of that doctor.
Okay, topic number two.
Rick Santorum called President Obama a snob for supporting universal higher education this week. Is the GOP presidential hopeful in the wrong, or is he right to challenge the College for All push?
The College for All push is silly. Everybody doesn't need to go to college, and I don't think it really makes sense to go to college. He said it in a stupid, destructive way, which I think did far more harm to his argument than good. If he had said, I'm for putting every American, you know, high school grad in a position where they can, you know, they can go to college if they'd like to, or they can go other way. That would have been fine, and he could have then said that President Obama seems to think everybody needs to go to college, and with that, I disagree, and I think that's snobbery. What he basically sounded like he was saying was that the president wanting to make sure Americans could go to college, what was some part of an insidious agenda. And I think Santorum just sounded like, sounded like a doofus.
Yeah, and to be fair to the president's position, he's not been saying that everybody should go to a four-year college. He certainly made it clear that he's talking about some form of higher education. And in the State of the Union address and in his budget, there was a big focus this year, actually, on vocational education.
Yeah, and I mean, so, you know, and for Santorum to talk about, you know, I sympathize with Santorum's point. And when he was talking about liberal indoctrination, very comfortable saying that most four-year selective institutions have strong political biases. I think it's ludicrous to suggest that you see strong political biases at most community colleges.
Topic number three.
On Tuesday, the House Education and the Workforce Committee passed Representative John Klein's ESEA reauthorization bills out of committee on a party-line vote. Are we any closer to a resolution on ESEA, or is Congress still stuck?
Still stuck.
Yeah, even worse, Bethany Little, who, you know, was point on the stuff for Harkin, is leaving to go join John Schnur. And, with Bethany leaving, that takes this whole thing a big step backwards in terms of institutional memory. So, you know, on the other hand, I think the department's very excited because if you get gridlock in Congress and the president gets reelected, the department now gets 5 years to kind of, you know, micromanage state school systems through, you know, pulling the strings on the waiver process.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty clear to me that you're right, that the Department of Ed has no interest in having reauthorization move forward. The thing is, you know, there still isn't, it's not that hard to figure out how they could find a middle ground here. I mean, there was all kinds of talk that, you know, over in the House about how the Republican plan was a huge step backwards. And in the end, it wasn't that much different from what came out of the Senate on a bipartisan basis. I mean, there's some important differences, but you can figure out a way to split the middle. I still think it's it's largely in the realm of what Lamar Alexander has proposed. It's kind of the middle ground there. So if people were serious about getting this thing done, they could get it done. I think there's blame to go around on all sides. The president, for sure. You know, people blame the Republicans for doing this in a partisan way in the House. On the other hand, you know, the Democrats didn't want to play ball because playing ball would have meant pulling the bill very far to the left, much further to the left than the Senate came out. So I just think there's a lack of leadership going on. If the president's reelected, and today that seems pretty likely, and if the Democrats hold the Senate, which today that looks, you know, quite plausible, then it does seem like we're in the same place next January that we are right now, which is going nowhere fast.
Well, and you've got this weird coalition, right? You've got the business community and the civil rights groups kind of, you know, fighting this NCLB dead-enders battle. And they're like...
Is it the business community, Rick, or is it Margaret Spellings in the civil rights?
Hey, it's the business roundtable in the U.S. Chamber speak for the business community in D.C. And, you know, they're shoulder-to-shoulder with the civil rights community.
Yeah.
And these guys are saying, by God, we need to hold on to subgroups and we need to hold on to... federally mandated interventions in schools. And as long as that's kind of the anchor on the left, I think it's hard for the DEFER types to go too far away from that because they don't want to split their coalition. So that does make it tricky to actually think about how do you do a re-auth.
Right. And so, you know, we have the status quo just goes on and on and on, which creates all kinds of uncertainty, which is difficult on local school districts, on states, and on providers, for-profit providers, nonprofit providers who might want to invest in this space and just don't know what the regulatory environment's going to be like. Not an ideal situation.
Yeah. I mean, on the waiver piece, the department can just tell states anytime. Like, look at the Florida conditional waiver. They can tell states that you're no longer in compliance with what we need you to do. And frankly, I mean, we're off into completely uncharted waters.
That's all the time we've got for this week on Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Were you happy with the Oscars?
Was happy with the Oscars.
Yeah.
Yep. I'll take that back. The artist, I didn't think was all that.
No.
Not really. No. I like The Help better, and I like Extremely Close and Incredibly Loud.
Wow, you're the only person.
Well, did you see it?
No.
All right, well, you should.
It got like 16% on Rotten Tomatoes, I think.
But you're a movie person.
I think.
Well, it might be a little bit too drama-y
Everybody said it was awful.
I didn't think it was awful.
Well, you didn't.
Are you trying to say I'm not everybody? Huh?
Now I've got to revisit.
Maybe Amber. How can Amber change that Rotten Apple score? I guess it doesn't count.
It's a little emotional. I mean, maybe it's more female than guy flick. Okay, maybe.
Now you sound like Larry Summers.
Okay, now
we're not supposed to be bantering anyway.
Yes, although the movie minute is kind of fun. But now we're on to the research minute. Amber, what you got for us?
We got the final summary report. This would be number 36 of the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program, better known as the Milwaukee Voucher Program, by Pat Wolf and colleagues. Sums up their 5-year findings. So from 06 to 11 of this 22-year-old voucher program, which now permits over 23,000 low-income Milwaukee students to attend one of 106 different schools. Vouchers worth approximately $6,500. They matched the voucher kids with the Milwaukee kids on similar characteristics and so on. The big finding, as you may recall, is that enrolling in a private school through the voucher program increases the likelihood by roughly 4 to 7 percentage points of a student graduating from high school, enrolling in a 4-year college, and persisting in college. Yet, in terms of achievement growth between the two groups, it was not so great. Didn't find anything, no differences between the first few years, but in year 4, which I didn't remember this because this is a summary, but the voucher students demonstrated higher reading growth than their match peers, though the math similar was sort of the same. This was also the first year the schools in the voucher program were required to retest all their voucher students and report the scores by their name school. So the analysts conclude that new test-based accountability likely played a role in generating the gains. Finally, they found the program saved the state money. Imagine that. $52 million in fiscal year 2011. So the report, I think, is a nice little summary. I mean, 36 reports, right? So they kind of put it all together, packaged it in this one report. And then they say, you know, guess what, people? There was no harm done by this choice program.
Wow, 36 reports boiled down to 1 minute. Amber,
achievement?
That was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Look, this is, I think, a really interesting finding. Maybe, you know, we're going to need more evidence in other places, but I think it's intriguing to say that when you combine school choice with these kinds of transparency measures, accountability measures, mm-hmm. You get something very exciting. You get stronger achievement. I think that makes a lot of sense to me, and it's in line with what we've been arguing for. It's nice to see it playing out on the ground.
Huh.
You're not so convinced?
No.
Why not?
Actually, Mike, this isn't a great week for you on the technical details.
Yeah, well, you know, look, I said it was speculative. I didn't say case closed on this one.
I mean, I think two things here. One, actually, you know, like in the DC stuff, too, you actually saw much bigger voucher gains in the out years because you get attrition in the voucher group. Mm-hmm. And so there's real concerns, especially once you get a few years downstream, that the vouchers are no longer necessarily representative sample because you had a lot of mobility in that group. Mm-hmm. And second thing, look, if the schools are testing everybody and reporting it, it's entirely possible that what we're seeing is what we saw in the, you know, what Mark Schneider wrote about for you guys is just a reallocation of energy. That initial wave of teachers are doing more of the stuff that's going to be assessed on the exam if they're administering it to everybody and less of some other stuff. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, and it's going to make test scores look better, but it's hardly an indication that the schools are doing any better. It's just a reallocation.
And even the findings, so the graduation findings, 4 to 7% better. Is that a big deal?
I don't think it's that big a deal, right?
It's
modest.
Modest. I mean, this is still the story of school choice, right? And most things in education reform, right? If there's any effect, it's modest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why is that? Rick?
most approve it in most of the world. I mean, this is what's insane, that anybody would ever think that letting parents choose one school instead of another was going to solve our problems. It creates opportunities for parents to find a better match for their kids. Mm-hmm. It creates opportunities to forge a more coherent school culture.
All right, but doesn't it basically support the notion that Diane Ravitch and others would say, that say, look, do whatever you want with school reform and education policy. You're not going to be able to get much leverage, because what's really mattering is what happens in the home.
No, it doesn't mean that. This is exactly where they get. And this is kind of the problem that these guys, you know, Diane got it wrong the first case. She helped overpromise what Choice would do. And now she's like, well, it didn't perform miracles. Choice creates opportunities to get your kid into school. It's a better match, to create more coherent school environments, for new suppliers to come into the space. What Mark, you know, that kind of market system matters is what fills kind of the vacuum you've created. Do you fill it with kind of rich, high-performing, talented schools that are doing a great job? Or do you fill it with a lot of the same old people doing the same old things in cruddy buildings in a strip mall? And, you know, a lot of Choice has been much more the second than the first. And so I'm not sure why anybody would expect to see dramatically better results. What we can do is use Choice as an opportunity to drive, you know, transformative improvement. And we've done a lousy job of that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it's a main advantage is just getting together a group of like-minded people. I mean, it sounds so simple, but when you get some really charismatic, you know, teachers and administrators who say, you know what, we want to punt the ball forward and we're going to stay here really long hours to do it, and we're going to keep experimenting and trying and retrying and hit the reset button. I mean, you know, and if you can get, I mean, really, that's what charter schools do, right? They can get these like-minded folks together that, you know, and you can get rid of the bad apples and so on and so forth. But
all right, great. Now, Amber, it is time for our quiz. You start with the one from last week.
Right. So last week we asked how many 25 to 29 year olds have attained their high school diploma or equivalent. That was 49, 59, 69, or 79%. Correct answer is, stop looking at the answers.
49. I didn't look.
69. 69. All right. New quiz. We're all sitting on the edge of our seats. Which state has the strongest charter law as measured by the Alliance? This is from 2011. Would that be Massachusetts, New York, Florida, or Maine?
I will keep my mouth shut. I know the answer.
You know the answer. All right. Our listeners log in to www.edexcellence.net/podcast.
To clear my head, telephone rang and you wanna chat. Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes,
sir. Hello, Chris.
How's it going?
It's good. Chris is wearing an Argyle sweater. I have a sense you're really gonna rock it today.
Well, we'll see about that. A Florida school bus dispatcher has been suspended with pay after police say she played Bonnie to her husband's Clyde in a bank robbery that took place late last month in Central Florida. Police say that Sharon Reynolds Bell, who has worked for the Orange County School District for nearly 24 years, was behind the wheel of a car that aided her husband, Johnny Bell, in robbing a TD Bank branch in Titusville, Florida. Believing she was the getaway driver, police issued a warrant for Reynolds Bell's arrest. Police say that her husband made off with $1,200, along with, unbeknownst to him, a GPS tracking device. After getting back into the car, the court records indicate Reynolds Bell asking her husband, quote, how much did you get, and quote, was it worth it? The veteran school district employee has been suspended with pay, as I said, meaning she's still earning $17.20 an hour. What's up with that? Our union's at work. Don't you love it, folks? She's innocent until proven guilty, so it looks like the Orange County schools will just be waiting quite a while this petty criminal's wages for this petty criminal's wages to come off the books. I'm not saying we need to do away with bus drivers' unions, but I am saying that bus drivers should be at-will employees. There's no question that what the outcome of the trial will be. How do I know she's guilty? When approached by a reporter earlier this week about the alleged crime, Reynolds Bell said, quote, I'm not guilty, and that's all I have to say, according to my lawyer. Her union lawyer, I'd imagine.
You know, Chris, I was really hoping that the school bus was going to be the getaway vehicle.
So I'll be honest, our producer Joe was the one who found this story and forwarded it along to me. And that was the impression the whole time until I really dug in. And yeah.
But, you know, it's probably true that maybe a school bus wouldn't be the best getaway vehicle. I don't know. If you saw a school bus idling outside a bank, people might wonder why.
Do you think that would be grounds to fire her, though, on the spot? She is the school bus?
Yes.
Or you think she'd still be suspended
no,
with
she
pay?
Might not be. It's really good. It's a really good point. Yes. Well, I will be curious to know how this comes out. I mean, in these situations, like, let's assume she gets convicted or she pleads and she's, you know, does she have to pay the money back that she's getting?
To the school?
To the school?
I have no idea. That's a good question. You know, because they can't fire her until she's guilty of the crime. So it's unfortunate the way these things work.
All right.
When it's so clear cut like this one.
But. Well, thank you, Chris, for this information. You know, this is the kind of information, the kind of stories that we suspect you listeners value every week, except for those of you who turn off the podcast before you get to this point. We know who you are. So again, if you find this podcast valuable, please tell your friends and colleagues they should be listening too, and email us at thegadfly@excellence.net with your stories of influence. Do it right now. And until next time, I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.